This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: anti-royalist activists turning to social media to call for the abolishment of the British monarchy. Tehran says Washington's latest sanctions show the U.S. is behind the false scenario accusing Iran of conducting cyber attacks in Albania. And the U.S. says that it has no hostile intents towards North Korea in reaction to Pyongyang's new law. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. 2 days have passed since the death of the longest reigning British monarch. Britons now think it is the right time to ask for Elizabeth II to be remembered as their last head of state. Hashtag abolish the monarchy is trending on various social media platforms. People think it does not make sense for another monarch to be elected in the 21st century. They also think the royal family is a political institution which lives off people's taxes and does not make any contributions to the society. Meanwhile, calls are growing in the former UK colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British monarch as their head of state. Some Commonwealth leaders have expressed doubt about what the role of the monarch is in today's time. Activists also argue that Charles's succession is an opportunity to redouble calls for slavery repatriations.
Britain has a new monarch. King Charles III used his first address to the nation since taking the throne to pay tribute to his late mother.
Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept, and she is mourned most deeply in her passing. That promise of lifelong service I renew to you all today.
Earlier, the new king, alongside Queen Consort Camilla, met well wishers gathered outside Buckingham Palace, paying their respects after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday. Gun salutes, floral tributes, and flags flying at half-mast symbolised the country in the first phase of an official 12-day mourning period. Messages of condolences flooded in from world leaders, with domestic tributes being led in the House of Commons by the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Today, we show the world that we do not fear what lies ahead. We send our deepest sympathy to all members of the royal family. We pay tribute to our late Queen, and we offer loyal service to our new King.
These are unprecedented times, and the parliamentarians will be getting used to saying God save the King instead of God save the Queen. But what will a monarchy under the stewardship of Charles III really look like? Charles's ascension to the throne comes following a seven-decade-long reign by the late monarch.
Lots of people who maybe were not great fans of the monarchy as an institution respected Queen Elizabeth II for her longevity, for her record. They forgot many of the things that she was also associated with, the end of empire, which was often very brutal in places like Kenya. But they gave her some respect, and you'll see that, I think, over the next 12 days. You'll see people prepared to give that respect to the Queen. I think it's going to be a very different story going down the road, and we should remember that the monarchy is very important to the British elite. The armed forces, the security services, judiciary, they swear loyalty not to Parliament, but to the monarchy.
Charles's new role as king comes at not just a tumultuous time for the throne, but for the country itself.
If he's going to be an effective king, he will have to speak to the nation in a way that brings people together. And that may involve him, and as Charles has known to do this in the past, be a very much more politically overly political monarch than some of his predecessors. He's made interventions on various issues, and I think he'll continue to do that going forward.
At home and abroad, there'll be questions about what Britain's new monarch's vision will be. Will the tentacles of the new reign bring forth a new dawn? Former subjects across the world will simply wait and see. Amina Taylor, London.
Ukraine's president says the country's forces have retaken control of dozens of towns as they push a counteroffensive against Russian forces in the northeast.
Up to now, the armed forces of Ukraine have liberated and took control of about 30 settlements in the Kharkiv region. In a number of villages in the area, activities to check and secure the territory are ongoing. Gradually, we take over new settlements. Everywhere, we return the Ukrainian flag and safety to our people.
Zelensky's comments follow reports that fierce battles are underway in Kharkiv region. Moscow has not confirmed any advances by the Ukrainian forces, but it says that it is sending in more reinforcements to the area. Intense fighting is also raging in the south, where a Ukrainian counteroffensive is making progress in the Russian-held Kherson region. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials say 8 people have been killed and over a dozen injured in attacks on a town in the eastern Donbass region. Russia has denied targeting civilians. A new report on poverty in France has revealed the devastating economic effects caused by Europe's sanctions on Russia over the Ukraine war. Multiple indicators have reached record lows, showing that their lower classes are worse off in decades.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next 2 economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed, because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran has roundly condemned the United States' imposition of sanctions against the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence and its minister. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said Washington's new bans, like its previous illegal sanctions, will not be able to sap Iranian authorities' will to serve the nation. He said that the United States' support for Albania's baseless accusations against Iran is a clear proof that the White House itself is behind the whole scenario, and that Tirana has fallen victim to Washington's move. Tehran's reaction came after Washington imposed sanctions on Iran's intelligence minister over alleged cyber attacks against Albania, which is a U.S. ally. Iran has dismissed the charges, saying that the Islamic Republic itself has been a victim of cyber attacks. Relations between Iran and Albania have been tense since the Balkan nation provided a safe haven for the anti-Iran terrorist group MKO. Local analyst Said Mustafa Khoshchishm says that the MKO terrorist group based in Albania conducts cyber attacks against Iran every now and then.
You know, the Albanian government is corrupt enough to be ruled by the United States. There is no denial of that. They've been hosting a terrorist group, thousands of them in Camp Ashraf in Albania and outside, who've been running software attacks, fake news media, as well as cyber attacks on Iranian facilities for quite a long time. And pictures and videos coming out from the hall shows that hundreds of them and maybe a thousand of them are sitting behind the laptop and running campaign against the Islamic Republic, which is not just fake news, but also cyber attacks. But the terrorist group, MKO, Mujahideen Khalq Organization, the hypocrites, MEK, PMOI, PMI, NCR, NCRI. No matter what they are called, they change names like the Al-Qaeda in Syria to clean up their records. It doesn't matter because they've killed 17,000 Iranian civilians and officials in the past several decades, including a prime minister, a president, a judiciary chief, a prosecutor general, as well as 72 MPs and 17,000 other civilians, and they have so much blood on their hands.
Palestinians have set an Israeli military tower ablaze in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Palestinian media say seven Israeli soldiers were also injured in the incident. The military structure, located at the entrance of Beit Omar town, was set on fire by a Molotov cocktail. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed it as a heroic act. A senior Hamas member says that setting the Israeli structure ablaze shows the fragility of the regime's fortifications. Palestinians have rallied in the Gaza Strip to slam Israeli violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque and the occupied Al-Quds. The Friday rally comes amid rising Israeli violations against the Holy Shrine. Ashraf Shannon reports.
A rally has been held in the besieged Gaza Strip to show support for Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds against the growing Israeli aggressions. Protesters have chanted slogans against the Israeli regime and called for an end to the Israeli occupation. Tensions have soared in Al-Quds in recent weeks as extremist Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against committing violations in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque will not be tolerated by the Palestinian people. Our people will defend Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque with all means. Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that must not be crossed.
People have come out to reiterate their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against the Israeli attacks. Al-Quds is a holy region of significant importance for all Muslims around the world.
Palestinian resistance groups will defend Al-Quds and will always be a safety valve to protect our people. Armed resistance is the key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
This protest is sending a strong message to the whole world that Gaza will not sit idly while Al-Quds is being desecrated. Al-Quds is the eternal capital of Palestine. We also want to condemn the daily killing of our people in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces and the construction of illegal settlements as well as home demolitions.
Since the Israeli occupation of Al-Quds in 1967, the city and Al-Aqsa Mosque have been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. Palestinians in the blockaded coastal territory say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
North Korea is facing criticism from several countries as well as the United Nations for declaring itself a nuclear weapons state. The UN chief has expressed deep concern over the North's new enshrining the right to use a preemptive nuclear strikes. Antonio Guterres has urged Pyongyang to resume talks to achieve sustainable peace. France also has condemned the law as a threat to international and regional peace and security. Paris says North Korea's aggressive declaration effectively eliminates the possibility of denuclearization talks. However, the U.S. has reacted cautiously, saying it has no hostile intent towards the North and continues to seek diplomacy. North Korea has officially enshrined the right to use nuclear weapons to protect itself. The North Korean leader has described the law as irreversible. The country is already under international sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. Local analyst Kim Do-shu says North Korea feels threatened by the U.S. military presence in South Korea, and that is the reason why Pyongyang says it reserves the right to defend itself in case of a potential attack.
So when the United States talk about a threat from North Korea, people in the West often ignore the fact that North Korea feels threatened by the United States, by the presence of the U.S. military forces in the soil of South Korea, remember. And also sometimes the U.S. will fly in, for example, B-52. That's a lethal force, obviously. I would say a real threat to the sovereignty and the security of North Korea. So both sides feel the threat from each other. They need to sit down and talk about their security issue and then move forward of building a normal country-to-country relationship. But so far, what we have seen is, you know, in Seoul, there's a new government which has given up the previous practice of engaging North Korea or sanction policy in the sense that is more engagement with North Korea, and so they can build a peaceful and stable relationship or stability in the Korean Peninsula.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Husseinia on July 27, 2022.
Besides the overall movement of the Islamic Republic, women have especially struck one of the most important blows to the West's lies and false claims. How? For many years, about 200 years, the West has said that if women are not freed from moral and religious boundaries and coverings, they cannot progress and reach higher scientific, political, and social positions. This is what they are saying. They are saying that women must be freed from these moral limits if they are to reach a high rank in society, politics, and other areas. Iranian women have exposed the falsity of this in practice. Iranian women have been present in all fields achieving success and glory, and all the while wearing the Islamic hijab. This isn't just boasting. These are the tangible realities of our society. Half or more than half of our university students are our girls and women. In important scientific organizations, some of which I have visited myself, our female scholars work in key scientific centers.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In literature and poetry, books and biographies, women are amongst the most outstanding. It is the same in athletic competitions. Sometimes one is truly unable to praise them the way they deserve to be praised. We have Iranian women standing on the winner's podium, the Iranian flag being raised and the national anthem being played before the eyes of hundreds of millions of television viewers around the world, and she is wearing hijab. She does not shake hands with the man who comes forward to give her the medal. That is, she observes the religious limits. Is this something small? I will give an example in the field of politics. When the Soviet Union was still in power, in one of the most important diplomatic missions that took place between the two countries, Imam Khomeini dispatched three envoys. One of them was a woman, and what a strong woman she was. May Allah's mercy be upon her. In the management of national affairs, our women have shown the best management in their activities whilst wearing hijab and the chador. In scientific matters and literary issues, in hosting television programs and in various other fields, Iranian women have been present and advanced to the highest levels whilst wearing the Islamic hijab and observing the hijab. This is something very important.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
African nations and Africans in the diaspora are reviving their efforts to obtain reparations from colonial powers involved in the evil transatlantic slave trade and other colonial era atrocities. In pursuit of this objective, early August, a reparations and racial healing summit was held in Ghana. Addressing the summit, Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo pushed for reparations, but reiterated that no amount of money could restore the damage done by the slave trade.
You cannot quantify the effects of such tragedies, but they need to be recognized. Africa and her peoples lost out tremendously in that period, and its ripple effects are still being felt right till this very day.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today's edition is focusing on the recent summit on reparations and racial healing held in Accra, Ghana. The meeting discussed and reflected on the legacies of the transatlantic slave trade, slavery in America, colonialism, and strategies for reparations and racial healing. The second segment of our show today is on the latest developments regarding Britain's controversial plan to forcibly send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Our guests will be giving us their expert analysis on today's subjects, and you can also be part of the conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
Africa demands reparations for slavery. A global summit on reparations and racial healing was held in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, early August. The summit was co-hosted by the African Union Commission and the Africa Transitional Justice Legacy Fund. The main agenda of the meeting was to coordinate a comprehensive global strategy and agenda to secure reparations for the immoral and brutal transatlantic slave trade and European colonialism in Africa.
Speaking to Ghana's Joy TV, one of the participants elaborates on some of the salient points of the Accra Summit.
One, the importance of prioritizing reparations, not just as a process of remembering, but as the path forward to the kind of self-determining agency that we want for Africa and for people of African descent around the world. We have a collective strategy that is now in development that engages not just the grassroots, but also we have the African Union Commission has been involved on this question of how to develop a common position for Africa on the issue of reparations and healing. So a lot of this was about building relationships between inside the continent, but also between Africa and the diaspora, so that we can know each other, understand each other, develop collective strategy to challenge and change the systems and structures that from the transatlantic slave trade through colonialism, neocolonialism, continue to exploit and harm.
Well, for more on the Accra Reparations Summit, we contacted Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
At the end of the Reparations Summit, a declaration known as the Accra Declaration was issued to push forward a global agenda for reparations and healing. Now, what is the importance of such a conference that took place in Accra?
Oh, it's extremely important. As you and your audience probably know, for a long time here in the United States, the descendants of enslaved Africans have been crusading, have been campaigning with regard to gaining reparations for the horrific depredations that were inflicted upon not only people of African descent in North America, but on the African continent as a whole. Indeed, Africa's underdevelopment today can be connected quite directly to the ravages of the African slave trade, which operated for centuries from about 1500 till about the late 19th century. And this meant that North America, the United States in particular, was built into its present superpower status by the free labor of enslaved Africans.
Speaking at the Reparations and Racial Healing Summit, Ghana's president said these reparations were long overdue and needed to be intensified. He questioned double standards in the reparations debate when it came to other races and ethnic groups that were wronged historically. Let's take a listen.
We believe the calls for reparations to Africa are just. The effects of the slave trade have been devastating to the continent and to the African diaspora. The entire period of slavery meant that our progress, economically, culturally, and psychologically, was stifled.
Now, I'd like to ask Mr. Horn, what's his take on the statement by the president of Ghana?
Well, he is absolutely correct. Recall that after what is referred to as the Holocaust, the killing of 6 million Jewish people in Central and Eastern Europe in the 1930s and the 1940s, you had the successor state in Berlin to Hitler's Germany pay reparations to Israel, even though Israel was not in existence at the time of the Holocaust. You still have reparations being paid to various peoples of Jewish descent, not only in Europe and in Israel, but in North America too. In the United States, you may recall that during World War II, 1941 to 1945, the United States in turn put in concentration camps Japanese Americans. About four decades later, the United States government apologized and paid reparations to those who had endured that horrible fate. And so I think the Ghanaian authorities were referring to these episodes when they made reference to hypocrisy and double standards, because it's apparent that hypocrisy and double standards persist.
The wealth of Western countries is built on slavery and colonialism, yet reparations have been routinely dismissed by Western leaders. For instance, the then British Prime Minister David Cameron, on a visit to Jamaica in 2015, rejected popular demands for compensation over slavery and colonialism. As expected, Cameron arrogantly stated that it was best for Jamaicans to move on.
No, I haven't been taken aback. Of course, this is an important debate. I mean, my view is that as we look into the past, we should think of all of the aspects of the past, not least the action that Britain took for many decades to wipe slavery off the high seas and off the face of our planet. And so I don't think reparations are the right answer. But the purpose of my visit is to look to the future.
There are concerns that the movement for reparations and apology will face major obstacles due to such stances by British officials.
Well, I think the London authorities need to rethink that inappropriate comment. One cannot understand or comprehend the British Empire, which once ruled a good deal of the world, including what is today's India, today's Pakistan, a good deal of Afghanistan and other neighbors of Iran. The British Empire was basically built upon labor of enslaved Africans. And so when the British authorities talk about it's time to move on, well, I think that that's not only insulting, it's obscene. They should be forced to apologize.
The president of Ghana also noted that even before these discussions on reparations conclude, the entire continent of Africa deserves a formal apology from the European nations involved in the slave trade for the crimes and damage it has caused to Africans. He lamented that Western countries are still practicing racism when it comes to reparations.
Predictably, the question of reparations becomes a debate only when it comes to Africa and Africans. When the British ended slavery, all the owners of enslaved slaves, Africans, received reparations to the tune of £20 million, the equivalent today of £20 billion. But enslaved Africans themselves did not receive a penny. Likewise, in the United States, owners of slaves received $300 for every slave they owned. The slaves themselves received nothing.
As Mr. Horne stated earlier, colonial powers involved in slavery must be forced to apologize. So why have these European powers so far refused to apologize and pay reparations for the crimes they committed?
Because they are enmeshed in a system that is not only immoral, but racist. And keep in mind, when we talk about the European nations that were involved in the slave trade, we're not only talking about Britain and France and Spain and Portugal. We're also talking about Denmark, for example. You may know that the U.S. territory known as the Virgin Islands was first controlled by Denmark before it was turned over about 100 years ago to the U.S. authorities. And of course, the Virgin Islands has an overwhelmingly black population because of the slave trade. The Swedes were involved in the slave trade. So this is a crime against humanity perpetrated by leading nations of Western Europe who purport to be paragons of human rights virtue, but actually are no more than pirates and thieves and immoral knaves.
The church, and especially the Roman Catholic Church as an institution, was instrumental in facilitating the transatlantic slave trade.
The church played a direct role and was complicit in the sins of anti-black racism, slavery, and segregation in the modern era. An African-American historian gives a glimpse of how the church was involved in enslaving Africans.
Catholics had used slaves and the slave economy to evade anti-Catholic laws and survive anti-Catholic violence. They embraced human bondage to secure their own liberty. The pro-slavery and anti-abolitionist tradition in the Catholic hierarchy began not with the arrival of the Irish in the 19th century, but with the emergence of the Catholic Church as a legal institutional church at the end of the American Revolution.
Now, what role should the Church play in pushing for reparations?
The Vatican should be in the forefront of the campaign for reparations, not only because the Roman Catholic Church was deeply implicated in the African slave trade. Indeed, you may be familiar with Georgetown University, a university that sits in Washington, D.C., and was initiated by the Roman Catholic Church. You may also know that about 200 years ago, when Georgetown University fell upon hard times, it sold scores of enslaved Africans in order to fatten its bottom line. And that's one of the reasons why you've had delegations of Black Americans traveling to the Vatican, engaging in discussions and consultations with the Vatican authorities about their role in the African slave trade, because the Vatican is supposedly a moral authority. That's one of the reasons why you had the Pope recently visit Canada, apologizing for what the Catholics did to the indigenous population of Canada.
It is a very emotional topic indeed for Africans, and we look forward to the day when the perpetrators of slavery apologize for their crimes and pay reparations. Here at Press TV, we shall keep you posted as Africans in Africa and the diaspora pursue reparations and healing. I would like to thank Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston, for his insight. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the controversial plan by Britain to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Stay tuned.
Britain ignores warnings over Rwanda asylum plan. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Reports have revealed that the British government was warned not to send asylum seekers to Rwanda as the government in the Central African country tortures and kills political opponents. The warning came several weeks before the British government attempted to forcibly send asylum seekers to Rwanda.
The controversial plan was temporarily halted after the European Court of Human Rights issued injunctions to force the cancellation of the first deportation flight hours before it was due to leave for Rwanda in June. London's High Court is also expected to hear the case in early September, when a coalition of human rights groups and a trade union will argue that the Rwanda policy is unworkable and unethical.
Britain's plan has attracted international condemnation. The spokesperson for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees says it is a violation of international law to send asylum seekers to Rwanda against their will.
Asylum seekers, people seeking asylum and safety. And we just want to reiterate that access to asylum should not be and is not contingent on the mode of arrival, how people arrive.
Now, for more on Britain's plan to forcibly send refugees to Rwanda, we contacted Claude Gachebuke, the co-author of the book Survivors Uncensored, He's also a survivor of the Rwanda genocide and currently the executive director of the Africa Great Lakes Action Network. Thanks a lot for your time today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the British government was reportedly warned several times by its own advisors that it's not prudent to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. So why did London ignore this advice?
I think London ignored the voice and the advice because at the end of the day, their attitude was they do not care about the well-being of the asylum seekers and the refugees who were seeking refuge in Britain. They were only looking to score political points. And at the time, there was such turmoil in the British government that it was just a nice cover-up to use the refugee issue and the immigrant issue, which is usually the default, to kind of hide behind and distract from the political issues.
Britain claims to champion for human rights, yet it has ignored human rights experts who have objected to plans to transfer asylum seekers to Rwanda. There is concern that many of the asylum seekers will endure suffering in Rwanda. A protester speaks here during a march against the controversial plan in London.
They are not looking at what exactly is in that country. They are looking at the fact that Britain is getting an opportunity to dispose of asylum seekers. But they are not seeing the life they are putting in danger.
What does it say of the double standards pursued by Britain and other Western countries when it comes to human rights?
I was actually one of the most vocal voices when it comes to this issue of transferring immigrants to Rwanda. I called it human trafficking. I called it slavery. I called it basically bundling people up and shipping them from Britain to Rwanda. What it says about Britain and Western, the West's attitude toward human rights is that the only human rights they care about are the human rights of people, Western people. It's well known that Rwanda has a horrible record on human rights, yet it still receives hundreds of thousands of dollars from the British, from the Americans, and from the European Union. And if these refugees were coming from countries that are Western countries, where most of the refugees were white, I believe, very strongly believe, that they would not be shipped to Rwanda.
The UK-Rwanda asylum plan has come under fire as rising numbers of refugees are crossing the channel in small boats to seek refuge in the UK. In July, 3,683 people crossed from France. The total number of this year is believed to be more than 17,000. Britain claims its policy of forcibly sending asylum seekers to Rwanda will help end the people smugglers' trade. But now many analysts disagree with this claim.
I absolutely disagree, because actually what Britain is doing by basically trading these humans with Rwanda, it's human trafficking in itself. The only difference is that this time it's legalized. It's government to government that are trafficking humans. You cannot take a person from a place that they desire to be and take them to a place that they do not desire to be.
Despite Iran's economic difficulties and unjust sanctions, the country generously hosts millions of asylum seekers from various countries, particularly Afghanistan. When he was the UNCHR chief, Antonio Guterres, the current UN Secretary General, visited Iran in 2014. During the visit, he paid glowing tribute to the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Iranian people for continuing to preserve asylum space for the refugees.
It is only fair to pay tribute to the generosity of the people and the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran that for decades have received, have protected, and have assisted, at the moment, almost 3 million refugees, still today almost 1 million refugees, sharing everything with them and providing them the access to shelter, to work, to education for their children, to health services, and allowing them to have a dignifying life while waiting for the possibility to go back home.
While Iran is hosting millions of refugees and granting them full rights, on the other hand, the self-proclaimed flag bearers of human rights, such as Britain, cannot tolerate the presence of thousands of refugees. What's your take on this?
That is such an irony that you point out. It just goes to show that when it comes to human rights, Western hypocrisy comes out flying. For example, if you would look at the criticism that Iran gets and the praise that Rwanda gets, and compare the human rights abuses in both places, it's crazy to see that such a champion of human rights would actually criticize one and go after the other. Now, with Britain not being able to tolerate even thousands of people who are in distress, that just goes to show that many times their claim to human rights is just completely lip service.
The Rwanda scheme presents a sad reminder of Britain's imperial past, the colonial transportation of slaves and workers across continents and seas. Imposing the asylum plan in a poor country such as Rwanda is financially beneficial to the UK and is seen as part of Britain's post-Brexit strategy. So, can we say that the Rwanda asylum plan is a clear reflection of Britain's imperial past?
Absolutely. I've been saying this since the very first day this deal was announced. I'd say that this is not only human trafficking, this is no different than the transatlantic slave trade, where humans were being traded for money. And so this legalized human trafficking between the UK and Rwanda basically takes humans against their will, takes them to a place they do not desire to be, and there is an exchange of money. There is a price for actually doing that service. So people are being treated like commodities. They're being treated like goods. And that's basically what was happening even with the transatlantic slave trade. And so today, this is just a complete reflection of Britain's colonial past, slave trading past, but also neo-colonialist attitude and imperialist attitude.
Well, there you have it. Britain's controversial plan to forcibly transfer asylum seekers to Rwanda is a continuation of its evil legacy of slave trade and imperialism. Thank you very much, Mr. Claude Bitabuke, for your incisive analysis today. And that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is your host Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sheikh Noor Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you to the studio and, of course, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Dear listeners, we are going to pick up where we left off last time, where we were talking about the consequences and harms of masturbation, and you mentioned a verse of the Holy Quran wherein the meaning of it was that Allah will not look upon the masturbators mercifully, and he will not speak to them on the Day of Judgment, and he will also punish them. But dear Sheikh, let's just circle back. We said last time that dhikr, remembering Allah, helps in not falling into this temptation. We also said that praying on time can also help. But dear Sheikh, many people, young men, young teenagers, young men and women who are not married, they say that it is even difficult for us to leave our homes. Some even choose to, as much as they can, stay home so that they do not go out and look at many different things and fall into temptation. Now, you did mention that one should safeguard one's eyes. One should not look. But how, I just want to ask, how does one safeguard one's eyes? Because it is very, very difficult, and I think a lot of people would appreciate some practical examples and a practical implementation of how one can safeguard one's eyes in our society.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that the narration that I share with you, actually it is a narration, not the verse of Noble Quran.
Okay.
He said that ثَلَاثَةٌ لَا يُكَلِّمُهُمُ اللَّهُ تَعَالَى وَلَا يَنْظُرُ إِلَيْهِمْ وَلَا يُزَكِّهِمْ وَلَهُمْ عَذَابٌ أَلِيمٌ. Three groups Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not talk to them in the Day of Judgment and do not look at them massively and do not purify them, and there is a grave chastisement for them in the Day of Judgment. One of them is annakihu biyadih, which is a person who is masturbates.
Right.
Okay. Actually, of course, we have in the verse of Noble Quran some verses to forbid masturbation. I do not want to go to that.
Right. We know it is haram, it is forbidden, it is
strictly
unlawful.
Forbidden, right. In the, you know, religion of Allah, religion of
Islam. It's one
Islam.
Of the greatest sins as well.
Exactly. About the point and the question that you mentioned, it is not necessary for you to stay at home. You can go out in public, but try to interact with those people who reminds you of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is very important. Just to visit your brothers and sisters in faith, go to Husseiniya, masajid, mosques, and, you know, these different places that to remind you of Allah. Not those people who always engage in sexual issues and talking about materialistic issues.
Okay? But what if one, dear Sheikh, does not have such a place, even, dare say, some religious places, and I don't want to mention names.
I see.
Even in these religious places, you find all sorts of haram things, to just put it lightly. So even that option has been taken. What can one do? Just do I have to build a mosque in my own home, my own room? What am I supposed to do?
I see. The one of the practical points here, and it is, you know, one of the maybe the most important ways and methods for controlling your sexual, you know, tendencies is, as I mentioned, is to have kind of prevention for that.
Right.
I described, if you remember, in previous episode, I told you to have marriage. It is very important.
Best and easiest step is marriage.
Yeah,
of course.
But if you couldn't, for, you know, financial problems, right, or any other problem.
Many young people can get married today.
Unfortunately,
it's very difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you do not have this ability to get married, then try to not engage your mind in sexual issues. It is very important. You know, I want to say that do not think about these issues from the beginning, okay? From first step, do not let to come to your mind.
So as soon as you start thinking about it, kill that thought right there. Stop
from the beginning. Because first step is very important, spiritually speaking, okay? If you do not let whispering of Satan comes within you, within your mind, because unfortunately Satan always has many satanic temptations. But if you do not let it from the beginning, it's much easier that you, for example, you want to stop it at the final step.
Right, okay? Of course.
I want to say that it is, and most of the, at least some of the Islamic recommendations, they're talking about the first step. I do not want to go to detail of that, but this divine religion of Islam always, at least for some cases, talking about the first step of the satanic temptations. If you look at Islamic laws, and do not want it to prevent human being from falling into the satanic temptation and falling into the sins, into the grave sins, not to let them from the beginning. And first step is to purify your intention, to always remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and not to have kind of, do not let your sexual tendency to have to increase. It is very important. Always remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As I said, you have on-time prayers. It is very important. And, you know, recitation of the verse of Noble Quran, you know, having some kind of relationship with the Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam, which we call it tawassul. These are keys, important keys for the prevention from falling into any other sin, especially about the sexual sins.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Dear Sheikh, you said that there were some steps, preventative measures that one can take. Could you mention some of these as an example so one can understand the concept of how we can prevent falling into this sin?
For example, about the sexual deviation in Islamic laws, we have, for example, not to shake hand with non-mahram, okay? Not to talk unnecessarily. Okay, not to flirting with the non-mahram.
So unnecessary interaction with the other gender.
Yeah, yeah, with other gender. I just want to, you know, these ideas, why this divine religion talking about these issues and this, you know, prevention? Because it wanted to, you know, some kind of safeguard human being from going to that, to falling into that sins from the beginning, from the first step. Okay, not to flirt, not to talk unnecessarily, okay?
Right.
Or not go to the personal issues of each other, not to engage in, you know, thinking too much about the sexual issues. Always try to remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You see how Islam wanted to safeguard you from the beginning, not to fall into that sin and to prevent you from that. Because unfortunately, this sexual tendency, if increased, it pushes you. You know, pushes you towards committing that sin. And it is sometimes very difficult to stop doing that. But if you prevent yourself from the beginning,